Ways and Means Public Safety Subcommittee for Wednesday, March 30th, 2005. Good afternoon, everyone. We are back continuing our discussion of House Bill 5044, the Department of Justice Phase 2 presentation. And we're starting with the Trial Division, Mr. Tim Wood, Division Director. And seated with him is Mr. Friel. It's good to see you back again. And we will be moving through two additional presentations, and then we'll be taking public testimony if anyone is here to do that. And we are also looking forward to a wrap-up discussion with Attorney General Myers.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Timothy Wood. My task today is twofold. One, try to bring us back on the schedule, and two, to walk through Trial Division. If you recall, I did have an opportunity to visit with the committee the prior presentation, and just a brief review. The Trial Division, if you recall, what we're talking about is that this is the part of the Department of Justice that is responsible for defending the state when it is sued. And so what we have up on the board is our mission statement, and there probably one of the more important issues that you look at is the fact that we're talking about defense. These are cases where, in reality, the state does not have a choice. We do not choose to be sued. Unfortunately, someone else has chosen to sue the state. The other part that you would emphasize in the mission statement is what happens in the event that we're not doing our job, and I think there's probably two parts to that. One is the dollar and cents component. When the counties sue us and they want their $10 million back as a result of action by this by the legislative body and we don't defend, they may get their $10 million back. Similarly, when this legislative body or the electorate or the voters make a decision about certain policies and there's a challenge to that policy, if we don't show up, then that policy is set aside. So, for example, you can think of the recent legislation dealing with, or the ballot measure dealing with Measure 37, where there's a lawsuit by 1,000 Friends. If you look at the expenditure, one of the things I would talk about and emphasize for this particular committee, that when we look at trial, there's two components of trial as far as dollars and cents. One is the other funds, the other is the general fund. I'm here to talk to you this afternoon about the other fund component of the Trial Division. Mary Williams, our Solicitor General, will talk about the general fund component of it. So our slide takes a look at the expenditure program total funds and how that compares with the rest of the department. As far as our core programs go, the best way I describe this, I think, is that if you think of the state of Oregon as one of the largest, if not the largest corporation, inevitably there's going to be litigation arising out of the activities of a corporation. It would be no different with the state of Oregon, so that when people are out driving their cars, we're dealing with employees, you name it, that if something goes wrong and there's a lawsuit filed, we would defend it. The only difference is that unlike a private corporation, that it's almost like any decision by state government can be challenged. So when Water Resources makes a determination as to how they're going to allocate water, for example, there may be a challenge to that particular decision. Our budget history is not unlike that of the rest of the department. You can see that there has been growth along with the rest of the department. As far as our budget drivers go, it's not surprising that personal services plays a large part in our budget. It's about 83%, where services and supplies is 17% of that budget. As far as how the dollars and cents are broken down within the Trial Division, I talked about other funds versus general funds. The next slide will show you that breakdown. Approximately $15 million are other funds, $4 million are general funds. Budget drivers, and if we look at this particular slide, actually if I were to do this again, I probably would put number one as far as a budget driver, is the fact of the matter is we cannot escape the fact that this is a litigious society. And so if you look at this particular slide in conjunction with the next slide, I think it will give credence to that, because what you find in looking at the next slide is that if you look at the growth of the number of cases that come into trial from 2001 through 2004, we see just the difference between 03 and 04, there's about a 20% increase in the number of matters that arise during the course of litigation.
Mr. Wood, are the budget drivers listed in the order based on the numbers associated with each category?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, the answer is no, that's not. In fact, what you look at when you look at the list here for our budget drivers, in large part, one of the things that happens as you put your budget together is you're required to look in the crystal ball and say, what am I going to see? It's 24, 36 months out. And in this particular case, when I put this particular slide together, as I was looking in the crystal ball and I'm saying, what's going to drive things for this next biennium for the 05-07? Forget for a moment just the fact the numbers, and that's what the next slide does, is look, I can't control who sues us for what. The numbers certainly drives. We have more work. But then if I'm going to look at this, what I we have like 27 cases dealing with priest abuse. And I say to myself, well, this is this the end or is this just the beginning? And then I look at it and go, my heavens, I think in it it's just the beginning, it's just the tip of the iceberg. And similarly, as far as institutional claims, I think all we need to do is to take a look in what the editorials and the articles that have been in the paper dealing with are the plight of children that are in foster care, and you look at all the problems that are associated with that, and then you look and see how that plays out at our end of the system, where we've taken, the allegation is you've taken the child too soon, you've placed them in the wrong place, you haven't carefully protected the person when you have placed the person. And you look at that and I say, is this a growth industry or is it going to remain stable? And in my own mind, it's a growth industry. Similarly with the Oregon State Hospital, and you look at the paper and you look at the problems associated with the Oregon State Hospitals, how is that going to play out in terms of litigation? Looking at a crystal ball, it would be my suggestion to this committee that that, in fact, is a growth industry and it's not going to pull back. Similarly, here you'll see I've got the Condemnations-Oregon Transportation Improvement Act. We have been in constant contact with the Oregon Department of Transportation. This Legislative Assembly has funded additional funding for improving projects. We're consistently reminded by both right-of-way as well as the construction side of it that that somewhere along the line is going to result in additional litigation. And in fact, when I look at the statistics for the past year, what I found was that there's a 50% increase in the number of condemnation cases that we're seeing. And in fact, in a recent conversation I had with the right-of-way section of the Oregon Department of Transportation, they say that trend will continue. So you take those budget drivers in conjunction with just the plain straight number of new matters that we see, and you can see that it is a growth industry. Budget drivers, another thing that I would look at to see what is happening as a result of this increased workload, we'd look at the number of hours billed by the attorneys, and here you can see that there has been an increase in the number of hours. One of the things we're asked to address is efficiencies, and this plays in to the policy package that you have before you for the trial division. The thing that I'll tell you is probably the mistake that I made the first time I had a chance to put a budget together. The first time I put a policy package together, I'm like that tool person that only has one tool in his or her toolbox, and that's a hammer. Well, in my case, as an attorney, when you look at budget and you look at problems and increased workload, your answer is, I need more attorneys. That was wrong, that initial approach. Because what I think our responsibility is to provide the least cost staffing for our clients. So in this particular case, when I looked at the increased workload that we had, I asked, how are we going to address that? And what you find in the policy package is what I said is, listen, we don't need additional attorneys. But what we do need is we do need additional support staff so that attorneys aren't doing the work that support staff should be doing. So efficiencies, we try to use the least cost staffing so that attorneys can focus on what it is that they do best. We also have brief banks, we have specialization, and I probably should add that there's nothing that we also try to keep a senior staff so that there's not the constant turnover. So our budget issues is that we did go and we did put together a policy package and said, listen, we need additional administrative support, and so you see policy package 462, which is asking for two FTE support staff positions with a dollar impact of $196,800. That was, it did get approved by the governor's, or it is a part of the governor's recommended budget.
Questions, comments? Thank you, Mr. Wood.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Mary Williams, our Solicitor General. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Mary Williams, Solicitor General, as the Chair just said. I'm going to try to move very quickly through the appellate part of this, and then we'll shift gears and take a look at the defense of criminal convictions. We've covered a lot of the material that's in the appellate piece in phase one, so I'll go quickly. If anybody has questions along the way, though, please stop me and I'll slow down as we go along. A reminder of who we are in the appellate division. Our job is to represent the state in state and federal appellate courts. So after cases and issues have gone through the other legal divisions in the department, if as they move into the appellate courts, that's when the appellate division becomes involved. And as far as how we fit in with the department's overall budget, we are 4% of the expenditures and 4% of the FTE. And the core programs we talked about during phase one, we'll talk about criminal convictions in a few minutes, but basically we do everything that the state's involved in. So in addition to the criminal work, we do civil cases, cases coming out of agency actions. We prepare ballot titles, and in the other are included some things that the legislature may assign to us that may move along quickly. It includes things like prison siting and energy siting facilities, but there are a number of sort of miscellaneous other kinds of cases that we deal with. And our budget history is pretty stable, both in terms of no increase in staffing over the last several years and then a slight increase in the budget over each of the biennia. And like most of the other legal divisions, we're primarily personal services is where the budget goes. Very small piece of that is services and supplies. And when we move on then to budget drivers, this slide has changed from mine. And I guess this is taken from, I'm not sure what time period this covers because it is a little different than the one I had. But what you'll notice here is that for the time period that this one covers, we had 60% of our work going to other fund cases and then 40% going to defense of criminal convictions. Typically, that's actually been the other way around, that we have done about two-thirds of our work has been in defense of criminal convictions and about one-third in other fund matters. That shifts both as the workload demands shift and as the critical cases that we're working on fall in different areas, then we have the ability within the appellate division to use our attorneys on any kind of case that we have to deal with. And part of what is happening and part of the reason for the shift to more of the other fund work is because of the reductions in the general fund for defensive criminal convictions. We've used our attorneys more to focus on the backlog of cases in the other fund area. That backlog has been coming down. The backlog on the criminal side has been increasing.
Are we looking at the time frame 01-03 then?
Madam Chair, I will have to find out what this slide currently covers because it has changed from the one I was working off of. I'll find out what the time frame is on that. And in terms of budget drivers, what we talked about in phase one is that we are mostly reactive. We have to deal with anything that comes in so that changes in other parts of the system will have a big impact on what it is that we see in our area. 95% of our cases, we are the respondent to an appeal that someone else has initiated, and only in 5% of the cases do we initiate the appeal. And in fact, we often will say that 5% is where we have some discretion. Our discretion is fairly small, even in that area. You'll notice in the news today that a judge in Multnomah County yesterday said that a state statute is unconstitutional. When that happens, we pretty much feel that we have to take an appeal on that to try to defend the constitutionality of the statute unless it's clear when we review it that there really is no basis for taking a shot at defending it. So although we have some discretion in being able to initiate some appeals. That's actually a very small piece of the workload, and we respond to the cases that are there and to the demands that the courts place on us. We're going to come back and talk about the cases that are expedited when I get to the policy package. And efficiencies we talked about in phase one, we've paid a lot of attention over the past several years to any way that we can to reduce the time we spend briefing cases. And in most of our categories, we've brought our average briefing time down. And at the same time, we continue to work on training and supervision to make sure that we're maintaining a consistent legal position. So this is an area that we have spent a lot of time working on. We've done a good job with it. I'm not sure how many additional savings there are out there for us to continue to find ways of adding to the efficiencies, but it's something we continue to work on. In phase one, we talked about some of the specifics of things that we've been doing to get cases through the system more quickly, and those are again highlighted on that slide. Major budgetary issues, and if you, when you take a look then at the distribution of FTE here, and then think back to the slide where we had how much we're doing as far as other fund work and general fund work, those ought to really match up. What this slide reflects is historically how we've had our appellate staff allocated to the different kinds of cases. And typically it's been, like I said, about two-thirds of our work on the criminal side and about one-third on civil administrative. That's been shifting in part to deal with resource issues, reduced resources for the criminal piece, and in part it also will shift depending simply on what kinds of cases we are having to deal with that need to take priority in the office. Our one policy package is to deal with expedited appeals. We don't deal with cases on a first-in, first-out basis. There are some cases that have to take priority over other cases. It used to be that the categories of cases that had to take priority, either by statute or by court rule, were land use cases, termination of parental rights, energy siting and prison siting cases, ballot titles, death penalty cases, and then any case in the Ninth Circuit, because that court, by rule, has very tight timelines for us, and any case in the United States Supreme Court, and again, because of the pressures from those courts. Recently, we've had two categories of cases added to that list, actually three categories. The appellate courts have added juvenile dependency cases into that group, and those are now treated like termination of parental rights cases. And I understand the policy reasons for that. When you have children in dependency situations, you want resolution quickly. And so they have expedited the briefing and the argument schedule for those cases, but that's also added pressure to our ability to respond to cases. The Oregon Supreme Court, I think primarily in response to criticism about how long it was taking them to have cases resolved in the court, they've also put every case in the court on an expedited schedule. So in the past, we've been able to deal with workload issues by pushing some cases off and focusing on the ones that are more pressing. We are not able to do that as effectively as more and more cases become expedited cases. The third category that's now a new category is last session the legislature enacted a bill that enables the state to appeal in some aggravated murder cases from rulings made during the trial. It's a good change. It's good for us to be able to have that, but one of the requirements is that we move those through very quickly. And we've had several of those appeals over the past year, and those also have to move to the top of the list. So what's happened is we now have every attorney has at least one expedited case on their docket. Some attorneys have as many as three or four that have to take top priority. And at a certain point, you simply can't do everything as the top priority, and that's what this policy package begins to address. Although much of the need is in the general fund area, the policy package kind of focuses on the civil part of the backlog and the expedited cases, and it would add a 0.5 FTE for a cost of $105,677. And that's a real quick trip through the appellate piece, and I'll stop if people have questions at this point.
Representative Cameron? No. Thank you very much for your presentation.
Okay.
And then if, let Kevin catch up on. Okay. So now we're going to shift gears and look again at the defense of criminal convictions, which covers both work that's done in the appellate division and work that's done in the trial division. And as a starting point, just sort of a reminder of the different ways people can challenge their criminal convictions. There are the direct criminal appeals following the conviction in the trial court, which is handled by the district attorney representing the state. And then we move on to post-conviction, which starts in the trial court and then moves to the appellate courts. And then federal habeas, which again begins in the trial court, this time in the federal trial courts, and then moves to the federal appellate courts. So those are the five basic categories of challenges that are covered in the defense of criminal convictions. This chart shows the breakdown of those five areas within our budget. You can see that most of our work is dealing with the direct appeals, and then smaller pieces for the others. Post-conviction trial work is the next largest. The smallest comes down to federal habeas appeals. And Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On the federal habeas appeals, would you envision that that's going to be increasing as we get more death penalty cases moving into the federal system?
Madam Chair, Representative Hansen, I think that as we have more of the capital cases moving into federal habeas, those percentages will increase. We are at the point where we now have our first death penalty case just beginning the federal habeas process, and probably in the 05-07 biennium we'll have at least one other beginning that process. And those cases will be very resource-heavy cases. And so what that will mean is having to shift away from some of the other work that we might be doing in order to deal with those cases as they move into the federal courts. And the budget history, actually, can you go to the next one, Kevin, because it's a little more visual. The large change from 9901 to 0103 is when we moved away from the subsidy, and Doug was discussing that yesterday. And otherwise, the changes in this area have been fairly steady. The budget drivers, the capital cases are a large budget driver for the work in this area because they do have to take priority and because they're the most complex cases that we deal with. And it fluctuates how many capital cases we currently will have in the system at any point. Right now, for some reason, we have more capital cases on direct appeal than I've ever seen. We actually have five of them that are currently active in our office. And because we will assign two to three attorneys on each of those cases, we are at 13 attorneys who have a death penalty case that they're working on, and that's a large number of our attorneys who should be giving those cases then top priority. The reality is they can't. They have to be able to do some other things as well. And then sometimes we will actually have a period where there won't be any direct appeals active. We'll be simply waiting for something else to happen on those, but for some reason we're in a very heavy period right now. Complexity of cases will, of course, sort of change which cases we have to be working on. One of the things we talked about in phase one are the U.S. Supreme Court decisions, Blakely and Crawford, and we're seeing a very large workload right now trying to deal with those decisions by the U.S. Supreme Court and what they now mean for these cases that are working through the system in Oregon. Part of what that's meant are cases that we thought had moved along through the system to a certain point are backing up as these issues are now being raised, and so we're having to take steps back on a number of cases as we deal with the Blakely and Crawford issues. And hopefully that's a workload that will resolve soon, but it's going to take some time for that bubble of issues to work through the system. Expedited caseloads, it's the same thing that I was talking about in discussing the appellate division. as we have cases in the criminal division, the criminal side of things, that are expedited, we have to give top priority to those. So if the Oregon Supreme Court allows review in a number of criminal cases, that's where a lot of our workload will then shift to. One other thing that I want to mention on the U.S. Supreme Court cases is that right now we have several cases pending in the U.S. Supreme Court where we're asking them to review cases. We have three of those that are general fund cases. One is an other fund case. And the court will be making decisions in the next month on whether it will take review on any or some combination of those cases. If the court does allow review on those are very resource-heavy cases because then you're making law not just for the state of Oregon but for the country, and it's a lot of work goes into those cases, and yet they're cases that we felt were important enough to ask the court to review. So depending on what happens on those cases, our budget may also shift to reflect that. The major budgetary issues for the trial division part of this, so post-conviction trial, federal habeas trial, the hours worked has gone up 11% from 0103 to 0305. And part of that is from reallocating staff to address the workload demands in the trial division. So we moved some positions that had been not filled in the appellate division to the trial division and filled those to deal with the backlog that was getting to a critical point there. But I also want to point out that some of the department's biggest billers are in this part of the trial division. So part of what this increase in hours is reflecting is attorneys working a lot of hours. They're working well beyond the average expected hours that we have for attorneys. And it's been crisis management. It's not something that we can maintain going forward without losing a number of very good people.
What does that mean in terms of a given week, attorneys working a lot of hours?
I can tell you from looking at sort of hours and attorney schedules and just knowing what people are doing. We have a number of people who work pretty much every weekend, who work more than 8 hours a day. And so I think I wouldn't be surprised to see averages that are closer to 55, 60 hours a week than to the 40-hour work week. And some of that will change depending on if they're kind of in the middle of a case that is going to trial or in trial. So there's a bit of fluctuation on that. But I know that a number of people are putting in hours on a daily basis to try to keep up with this workload. In the appellate division, we have a similar increase. There's no change in FTE from 0103 to 0305. This is just an increase in the hours worked. And again, it's largely driven by people feeling pressured to get the work done and so putting in the extra time that has to be done in order to move these cases through. Looking back to post-conviction trial work, in the Phase 1 presentation we had, I think, a shorter version of this. The important thing on this slide is to pay attention, I think, to that trend line. The increase in the backlog of cases is only going to go up, and this kind of shows how it's been over the last since 1995, and we expect that's going to continue to climb and probably climb fairly dramatically as we have fewer resources to deal with these cases and more cases will be backing up. And on the appellate side, this is for all three categories of appeals, the direct appeals, post-conviction, and federal habeas. We also have cases that are, the backlog is climbing, and that's the line that you see. It's sort of you see it in 98, 99, 2000, and then there's a break, and it's 2002 to 2004. In the time from when I did the Phase 1 presentation to today, that backlog of criminal cases has gone up 5 cases per attorney working in this area. So just over that short period of time, we've seen a significant increase in the cases that are sitting on an attorney's desk waiting for somebody to do something with them. And partly that's a result of the Blakely cases moving kind of backing up in the system. But what we expect to see is that backlog climbing significantly in the 05-07 biennium. The governor's recommended cuts, the 10% reductions. I thought this one would show up. One slide before. The on the federal habeas, what this slide shows is a very nice demonstration of how our workload compares to some of our neighboring states. So when you're looking just at the federal habeas trial cases, it's one of the few areas where we're able to get comparison data for other states because other states have similar systems for handling that particular group of cases. And so for cases per attorney, in Oregon we've got 84. You can see for the neighboring states, the next highest is Nevada with 52. California has only 11 cases per attorney. So our attorneys are being expected to do an awful lot compared with the state attorneys in the neighboring states. So the 10% reductions are about $1.3 million. And we'll talk about what that translates into. First of all, it translates into about 11,000 hours of attorney work on these cases. And it's going to mean an increase in the caseloads and an increase in the backlogs in all of our case categories. It may mean that in some cases, we will simply not be able to appear in those cases to represent the state's interest. And we're going to get to another table, and I'll talk a bit more about how that actually plays out differently in these five areas. But we've sort of done everything we can do to deal with the reduced funding in ways that allow us to still appear in the cases. We've looked for ways to take shortcuts. We've kind of run out of the shortcuts. And at some point, we're simply going to hit the point of not being able to appear in some cases.
Ms. Williams, I'd like to stop you just for a moment. I'd like to introduce several young people. They are pages today. And they're all from Fernwood Middle School in Portland in my district. It's great to see you down here. And we have two available chairs here on the end. I would ask you to self-select. And two of you come on up and join us.
They changed from yesterday.
That's great. In fact, let's make room for one more. Senator Winters is away for a time recovering from surgery. If there's another person who would like to come up and be Senator Winters, rather. Great. Right here next to me. Thank you for joining us.
Please continue. Thank you. One of the things that it's important to understand is as we reduce the work that we're able to do on these cases, it doesn't simply mean a savings for the state. What that actually means is that the cost shifts from us to the judicial department. And I'll talk some more about that when we get to a table that kind of gives you an overview of all of this. Some of the other reduction issues simply delay, that the cases are going to take longer to be resolved as the backlog increases. That means that as that delay increases, when we lose a case and it then has to go back to the county for a retrial, if there's the more delay there's been, the greater the likelihood that the district attorney will not be able to re-prosecute the case. And so that delay becomes an important concern for us. Now, this is the table I wanted to spend some time on because it's colorful and it's good. When we were looking at how are we going to deal with the reduction in the Defense of Criminal Convictions budget, we tried to figure out the kinds of cases we've got in these different areas, which of them you would prioritize working on, and which would have to kind of fall below that line. And so what this shows is for the five different categories of review, the direct appeal, the two post-conviction stages, the two federal habeas stages, and then along the the far left are the kinds of cases that may fall in those categories, and in the table whether we would consider working on those cases to be essential or just critical or just necessary. The reason that the our work on the appellate cases is actually less important in looking at this than our work in the trial courts, and I want you to understand the reason for that. On appeal in the state appellate courts, we have had a judgment from the trial court, typically where the state has prevailed. And the question in the appellate court is whether the court will uphold or reverse that judgment. If the state doesn't appear, the appellate court still has an obligation to consider whether that judgment is a correct judgment. And so whatever challenges are made to the judgment, if we're not there to respond to those challenges, the state court will have to do that for us. What it means, though, is if we don't appear in the appellate court, it doesn't mean we automatically lose. It means that the appellate court is going to have to do work for us. We think it means we'll lose more often as they are taking over that job. But they have the constitutional obligation to do that work that we otherwise would do. In the trial court and in the federal appellate court, that's not the case. So if we don't appear in those proceedings, the state may simply lose. And that is the reason for, as we look at dealing with these reductions, the reductions are more likely to impact the appellate side of things, and we may have to kind of shift resources internally to deal with keeping the trial workload going, letting the appellate cases back up as much as they can. Many of our cases are reaching that outer limit where the court will not permit us to extend those beyond that, and that's where we're going to have to start looking at simply not appearing in some of those cases. And the other thing I'd ask you to note on this is if you add up all of the critical and necessary, that doesn't get us to the 10% cuts. And so we have to be moving into some of the essential categories to deal with the cuts that we're facing on these. And that's it. If I can answer any questions, I'm happy to.
Comments, questions? Thank you. Good. Oh, Representative Hansen, my apologies.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. Is there an opportunity before we reach the various levels of appeal to negotiate an outcome?
Madam Chair, Representative Hansen, it's very difficult to negotiate outcomes in the criminal justice system. We have had some cases where the case may be in a sort of a variety of stages when we realize that something else should have happened in the case. And the state has wanted to go back and have something different happen. And that's very hard to do in the criminal justice system. One case that you may be familiar with, the Happy Face Killer, got a fair amount of media attention, where an individual admitted to committing some crimes, others had been convicted of those crimes. And it was very difficult for us to figure out how we could go back and do anything to change those convictions depending on where they were in the process. So even though we agreed that something needed to happen, it wasn't an easy thing to resolve. One of the things that you end up having to look at is the governor's clemency or pardon authority. That may be one of the few ways that you have actually to reach some different result. In those particular cases, we kind of fudged the system a little bit, and everybody agreed we would take some actions that would get us where we needed to go, even though it wasn't probably the way things would work if everybody was following the rules. But it was quite a challenge to actually find a way to resolve these. They're difficult to reach any sort of settlement. So this process is pretty much the one that's required by the constitutional requirements.
Thank you very much. Civil Enforcement Division.
Madam Chair, as the transition between speakers, I'd like to remind the folks here for public testimony, if you plan to testify, there's a sign-up sheet on the table. Please sign up for it. As soon as this presentation is done, public testimony is scheduled.
Thank you, Mr. Wilson.
Good afternoon, Mr. Boss.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, my name is Fred Boss. I'm an Assistant Attorney General, and I am Chief Counsel of the Civil Enforcement Division of the Oregon Department of Justice. The Civil Enforcement Division is primarily the Civil Plaintiffs Trial Division of the Department of Justice. To refresh your recollection, we sue to obtain money or to enforce the state laws in civil court, although we do have one aspect of our division, the Medicaid Fraud Section, that does some criminal prosecutions. The Civil Enforcement Division is the second largest legal division within the department. It has 132 FTE, and the governor's recommended budget is $26.94 million. And that's not the right slide. But we'll move on. Thank you. There are five sections arranged in practice groups. There's our budget history, and it's probably best reflected in the graph. So, thank you. One thing to note in, if you'll note a jump in 2001 and 2003 in the actuals, we added FTE into our Medicaid fraud section and into the non-participating manufacturer tobacco enforcement section. The budget drivers, like most divisions in the Department of Justice, is primarily personal services, which is 75% of our division's budget. Our budget is derived primarily from other funds billing to agencies, although we have roughly 29% other funds that come in from fees in our charitable activities section and settlements in the charity section and in the consumer protection section. One of the key program changes is in our Medicaid fraud section, and the governor's recommended budget eliminates one FTE in that section. That FTE is an assistant attorney general. That is a position that is now vacant. The result of this reduction will be primarily a reduction in our ability to recover losses due to Medicaid fraud and abuse. Chair Gordley, I understand that Senator Devlin did have a question as to how Medicaid recoveries were allocated a few days ago, and if I could address that.
Certainly.
There are four types of recoveries for Medicaid fraud. The first type is a recovery that comes in to the Medicaid program, such as if we were suing for an overcharge. If there is a recovery there, that recovery is taken and given to the Medicaid program, and then the federal government is reimbursed for their contribution to the Medicaid program at the rate that is set in October of each year. And this year it's currently 59%, and I think it hovers around the 60% area. The next type of recovery that Medicaid fraud would have would be for penalties that could be assessed against an offending parties. Those go 100% to the Medicaid program. The another type of recovery is restitution. This section prosecutes nursing home abuse cases, and often there will be individuals who will have suffered some financial loss, and if we recover a restitution element, that goes 100% to the victim. The final type of recovery is for attorney's fees and costs. Those go to the Medicaid Fraud Control Unit, and we are, in theory, to repay the federal government their 75% portion. As you may recall, this is funded 3-to-1. We often will negotiate with the federal government to keep that portion within our program in order to apply against the various costs that come forward in the program. That's what we call a program income. So if you see that in some of our budget documents, that's what that is.
Senator Devlin.
just a clarification then. The first type that you identified, then the distribution of those proceeds would be, they're approximately the same as what the current share is for existing programs in the sense of Medicaid versus state dollars. That's what I'm hearing. They go back to them basically the same way they probably were received.
Madam Chairman, Senator Devlin, roughly.
Roughly.
It's a different allocation from the funding of the Medicaid Fraud Control Unit, which is the federal government takes a 75% funding share of our control unit. The first type of recovery depends on how the federal government funds the Medicaid program itself.
Okay.
That changes that the state and the federal government negotiate yearly how that works.
Okay.
This year it's 59%.
One final follow-up, and I appreciate the detail. This was an area that was in a lot of the literature 4 or 5 years ago. I mean, you practically found it in every magazine that goes to legislators, regardless of its source. Is it a declining? Obviously, enforcement is what's made it probably decline, and keeping the enforcement is what will keep it declining. But is it a declining issue, or is it a growing issue?
Madam Chair, Senator Devlin, I think I'll have to get back to you on it. If you don't mind, I'd be pleased to get back to you on that.
Thank you, and please continue.
We would like now to turn to our Financial Fraud Consumer Protection Program, and Attorney General Myers and Attorney in Charge Pellegrini will address this section.
Good afternoon, Mr. Attorney General and Ms. Pellegrini.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. May I have some letters?
Certainly.
For the record, my name is Cheryl Pellegrini, Oregon Department of Justice. As this slide demonstrates, you'll notice in the 0305 legislatively approved budget, that reflects the suspension of general funding for the program, and that was about a $2 million suspension of funds. You'll also notice that in 0507, it appears that the program will break even, but that thereafter, we believe, sometime during the 07-09 biennium, program may become in serious financial jeopardy. The suspension of funds in 0305 was due to the budget climate and a belief by the Assembly that the program could survive on funds generated from case settlements and the projected beginning balance. Now, absent some additional funding source, we forecast, as I said, that the program funding will be exhausted in 2007. What's at stake here is this program, which is the only agency within state government that is charged with protecting consumers and the marketplace. And I point that out because we no longer have a Better Business Bureau presence in Oregon. They've moved to Seattle. There is no consumers union here. The district attorneys are not equipped to handle consumer complaints or trade practice cases. They refer them to this office. The Department of Consumer and Business Services and other state agencies that serve a limited consumer protection function are primarily business regulation agencies. They don't do what we do. And there is no federal agency that provides assistance for individual consumers. This is not insignificant. In 2003, the program recovered $8.9 million for the benefit of Oregon consumers and citizens. In 2004, we recovered $6.6 million. The program is dependent, has been historically, on three funding sources: the beginning balance that it starts each biennium with, the general funding contributed by the assembly, and the revenue that we generate as a result of the enforcement cases that we bring during a particular biennium. You'll notice that in the 0305, that general fund was eliminated. We did start with a significant beginning balance. Case settlements, I think, were around $5.5 million, and we began this biennium with approximately, I think, a little bit more than a $2 million beginning balance. However, this biennium, we are now dependent solely on case settlements, and the danger there is that this income stream is a very erratic one. We may go several months without a settlement and with no funding coming into the program. Historically, we've relied on general funding to ensure a steady income stream and to support the program. We anticipate that case settlement funds alone will not be enough to sustain the program throughout the 07-09 biennium, absent some action. This graph pretty clearly illustrates that, and I would note that the 07-09 ending balance is reflected by a broken line. We acknowledge that the program cannot continue to operate without funding, and that we must begin now to explore, identify, and develop options to keep this program funded. At this point, the options appear to fall into two categories. These are not mutually exclusive categories. First would be for the legislature to restore some portion of general funding for the program. The second alternative there would be to identify an other fund source. I will note there are two options here that are currently being contemplated. One, we're very grateful to Representative Hansen for introducing House Bill 3152. What that bill would be to increase the business registry fee paid to the Secretary of State and would dedicate those funds generated to the Department of Justice to assist in supporting the Consumer Protection Program. There is also another bill, Senate Bill 216. That is been designated the non-fluid recovery bill and is currently before the Senate Judiciary Committee. And there, I believe, is now an effort, or at least the possibility is being explored, of diverting these recoveries in part, at least, to the Consumer Protection and Education account, and then in part to state lands where they would ultimately benefit the Common School Fund. The second alternative is to alter the program in some way. And in doing so, the focus here would be to preserve maximum flexibility for the Attorney General. And at this point, I would defer to Attorney General Myers to address this for the committee.
Madam Chair, members, for the record, Hardy Myers, Attorney General. I'm going to have a few additional comments about this area in my closing remarks, Madam Chair, if I may, but for the moment, in relation to this presentation, the thing I want to observe, which is obvious to all the subcommittee, if we go back to the ending balance slide for just a moment, that the program faces significant challenges during the coming biennium, and as Attorney General and therefore the ultimate steward of this program, I'm going to be called on to make some very important decisions about the program, perhaps among the most important I've had to make as Attorney General, because of course I'm the steward of all of the mission areas of the Department of Justice. I'm going to talk about the funding briefly in my closing comments, but for the moment, I think the thing I would like to underscore for the committee is my hope that the subcommittee will preserve to me maximum flexibility in making those decisions. To the extent they may involve changes in enforcement policies, to the extent they may involve changes in the personnel of the area, there are various decisions that I'm going to have to confront. And my respectful hope would be that the subcommittee would, in terms of presently authorized positions, expenditure limitation, that you would allow me for the coming biennium to try to deal with the different choices I'm going to face with the present flexibility that I have as Attorney General, and that the subcommittee would not attempt to try to predict or itself make those decisions in the administration and management of the program. And of course, the most fundamental commitment I can make to you, to the assembly, to the wider public, is that I intend to try to make those decisions as wisely as I can, and it is certainly not my intention to allow the program to run up the cliff at the end of the next annual. That is definitely an outcome I want to try, to the extent I can affect that, to avoid.
Mr. Attorney General, let me just say here that we will work with you around getting to that flexibility that you're asking for. I would also just remind my colleagues that in the guiding principles for making our budget choices, and as you are aware, Mr. Attorney General, we prioritize protection of victims and services to the citizens of Oregon. That's a high priority. So we will work with you. What that looks like, we don't know yet, but we certainly will make that commitment to you. Senator Devlin?
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm trying to understand the graph that you had up previously, major budgetary issues. The section there, CS, the case settlements, although they're projections for 05, 07, and they seem to be relatively consistent from 99 on. Obviously, the first biennium on your graph is significantly less. Is there any reason to believe that your settlements might be appreciably less than what they, for instance, than what they are in the current biennium? In the 05 or 07 biennium? I know it's a forecast.
Madam Chair, Senator Devlin, they well could be. We're basing this principally on historical information to project forward. But as I said before, because we're dependent on identifying cases and then investigating and prosecuting them to their conclusion, some of them we take through, for example, the Blockbuster case that just was announced yesterday. That was a significant and large case. It netted $630,000 in a national settlement, but out of that, Oregon received $30,000. So it's hard to say.
But the crux of your, Madam Chair, so the crux of your problem here appears to be, and I don't know to what ability the Attorney General has the ability to move funds within divisions, is your beginning balance. Your beginning balance there in the next biennium looks like a couple hundred, $200,000-$300,000. You know, you're never going to have a scenario in which we would be able to operate a substantial portion of your program with general fund dollars. It would also always have to be somewhat. Does it look, if you could have the same beginning fund balance that you have in 05, 07, or I mean that you, I guess in 05, 07, in 07, 09, would you feel a lot more comfortable? Which is looks like roughly about $1.5, $1.8 million, something like that.
Madam Chair, Senator Devlin, yes.
Yeah. So that's really the core of the issue.
That would make a significant difference.
But even if the, Madam Chair,
look at numbers. I mean, it looks like, you know, it's expensive.
Even if the, even if the Attorney General modified your practices, you would still have the problem of a beginning fund balance.
Madam Chair, Senator Devlin, that is correct.
Okay. Thank you.
I asked about the charge. It's hard to see.
Additional comments? Representative Hannah?
Thank you, Madam Chair. On that chart, the 0305 to 0507, the beginning balance changed drastically, yet the expense line doesn't correspond to the change in that beginning balance. Where did the beginning balance go?
Sorry, sir. One more time.
The beginning balance reduced by close to a third from the 0305 to the proposed 0507. And then if you go to 0709, it goes down even further. But the expense line doesn't correspond. Where is that beginning balance going? I mean, where are we losing the balance? See what I'm saying? Your beginning balance is going down.
Just a slide.
Two. You're losing beginning balance each biennium. The expense line does not proportionately go up.
Madam Chair, could I?
Senator Devlin.
But if you'll note, the expense line doesn't go up, but it is always exceeds the current settlement line. So you're always drawing down the beginning fund balance.
I got that.
Yeah.
The chart doesn't.
But it doesn't correspond.
Okay. We can need the numbers, section numbers.
Would you like the numbers that correspond?
Yeah, the numbers, because the chart makes it look like you're... It doesn't match up.
Madam Chair, if I may. In 0305, should we start there, Representative Panner?
Yeah, and maybe you can give them to us rather than us trying to
write
them all down.
Sure. Why don't I provide
them
to you afterwards? Yeah. I'd be happy to do that.
We might all want them, but...
Sure.
That'll be helpful.
Sure.
Thank you.
If I may, Madam Chair, just one point I would make about the further reduction, elimination of consumer education and outreach programs and individual consumer assistance. I wanted to relate that to the packet of letters that I had distributed to the committee. Those are letters that we've received, just a sampling of letters we've received this biennium from individual consumers acknowledging our work on their cases. These are cases that never saw the inside of a courtroom, that were handled informally, in which the business was contacted and was persuaded to resolve the issue that the consumer had raised. That's the sort of assistance that we will no longer provide if this program is, or aspects of this program are eliminated.
Additional comments or questions?
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Mr. Attorney General and Ms. Pellegrini.
Madam Chair.
Representative Hanna.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Wilson, in your comments on the civil recovery within the budget detail, I didn't see a lot of about this beginning balance reduction through a period of time. Can you comment any further on that?
Madam Chair, Representative Hanna, actually the agency came to me soon after the turn of the year, after we had drafted that and started showing me what was happening with the cash balances, and I think we start raising concerns also. And so, I mean, that becomes dated material, of course, the day after we write it. But we recognize the problem, and in fact, we've been trying to raise it a little bit. Noticed in my major budget points, we raised it.
Yeah. Follow-up, Madam Chair. I know we're going to get the numbers, which I think will be helpful because the graph doesn't proportionately look the same. But, Mr. Wilson, if we could have a little bit further review on that topic, I would like to do so.
And I've also said to Mr. Wilson that this is a subject that we will want to put back before the co-chairs for more attention.
Madam Chair.
Welcome back.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Fred Boss. I am Chief Counsel of the Civil Enforcement Division. I would like to continue on with one other major budgetary issue, although it's perhaps not major, but it is something that we are watching. Our charitable activities group, the ending balance is declining there. We anticipate at the end of the 05 or 07 year that in each of the programs, charities and gaming, there will be, in essence, 2 months' worth of operating capital there. We are watching that. It certainly is manageable through the upcoming biennium, but we may be coming in the next legislative session to discuss some solutions. I would point out that in the charities area, there has not been a fee increase for 20 years, and in the gaming program, there has not been a fee increase for 14 years. That is merely one of the options, but I don't know whether it will be even an issue by the end of that biennium. We do have one other fund's policy package that I'd like to discuss. That is the establishing of a probate litigation unit in the civil recovery section.
Madam Chair.
Representative Hanna.
Excuse me, Madam Chair. Thank you. You said, I think, that there had been no fee increase from the charities. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, Representative Hanna, yes.
But during that same period, from a period from the 90s through current time, we've also gone from 3,000 to 13,000 charities. So has that not been a substantial increase in your revenue?
Madam Chair, Representative Hanna, yes. I was just that. If I may, that was just one of the potential solutions. There are more charities now.
Thank you.
Please continue.
This policy package of an estates litigation unit was requested by the state agencies. We currently hire attorneys as special AGs at a higher billing rate than our internal billing rate. By bringing this work in-house into the Department of Justice, the agencies would either gain more services at a less cost or be able to have reduced costs. The program or the policy package entails two assistant attorney generals and one legal secretary. And I believe there is the total package cost.
Madam Chair.
Representative Lizard.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Does your hourly rate, does that include the benefits, the first package, retirement, medical benefits, and all that?
Madam Chair, Representative Wisnett, I believe so, but I...
Yes.
Yes.
So, Madam Chair, as a follow-up. Thank you, Madam Chair. So it is a true savings by bringing it in-house, if you anticipate.
Madam Chair, Representative, yes.
Thank you.
That concludes my remarks concerning the Civil Enforcement Division. I'd be happy to address any questions.
Thank you very much, Mr. Boss. I think we've worked our way through questions. Thank you. We are going to move into public testimony on House Bill 5044, and the record should also reflect that we have a quorum present. We'd like to start with the two people signed up who live more than 100 miles from the Capitol, Vanessa Becker and Dan Norris. If the two of you would come forward. And then following them will be Gretchen Bennett and Tanya Hunt.
Good afternoon. My name is Vanessa Becker, and I am here to talk to you a little bit about the ODSVS funds. I am actually from Roseburg, Oregon, and have been in the field of working with domestic violence and sexual assault victims for about 13 years, and am currently acting as the executive director of Battered Persons Advocacy, who actually receives some of those funds. So just to tell you a little bit about myself first.
Tell us where you're located.
Roseburg. Douglas County.
Thank you.
Absolutely. And we provide services for all of Douglas County, so we're the only provider of such services in the county. So first, I think it'd probably be important to explain just briefly what sorts of services Battered Persons Advocacy, or BPA, provides. We've been in the community, we're a private nonprofit, we've been in the community of Douglas County for about, actually not about, but 27 years. So we have a solid history of providing those services. And we provide a myriad of services, and they really focus around safety and safety for victims of domestic violence and sexual assault. We provide a 24-hour crisis line. We're the only crisis line that runs 24 hours in the county. We also provide emergency services such as food boxes, door lock changes, cell phones. We do emergency safety planning. We also have a shelter, which when a lot of us think of domestic violence programs and sexual assault programs, we think of a shelter. So we have a beautiful shelter facility. We also have sexual assault specific services, meaning that we have a response, an entire team in our community that responds to sexual assaults at the hospital, rapes that happen. And we also provide transitional services, so services that are designed for families who are coming out of an emergency situation, who are stabilized, but need some additional support, you know, for up to a couple of years to help get them back on their feet and stay safe and have healthy relationships. So that's sort of our services in a nutshell. Our annual budget is around $500,000, and that's been pretty typical budget, anywhere from $500,000 to $600,000 yearly. The ODSVS funds account for about 8% of that funding. We actually have approximately 35 different sources of funding, and what that means for administratively is quite a task to keep track of, you know, 35 different sources of funding. But, you know, it's really important to have that diverse funding base. Probably the best way for me to describe anecdotally what happens and the impact that domestic violence and sexual assault has in our community is to just briefly give you a story of a client who I actually worked with just recently, and it was a very public case. I actually went to trial, and she's given full permission to share her experience, as well as some of the poems and some of the things in her picture. If you're interested, I can pass that around too. And in your packets, which I think we're going to be passing out to you, we've also got copies of the poems and things that Naomi gave. So, first of all, we got a call, Battered Persons got a call around 9 a.m. on February 12th of last year, 2004, and we were requested to meet the SART team, or the Sexual Assault Response Team, at the hospital to a rape. We responded quickly, as we normally do, along with the trained paramedics who have been trained in domestic violence and sexual assault response, as well as the nurses and the staff at the emergency room. And what I actually responded to that, and in the 13 years that I've been working in this field, I'd have to say that was probably the worst domestic violence, sexual assault case I'd ever seen. It moved the entire hospital. When you've been in this field, you know, we work in crisis every day. And when you walk into the hospital and you see doctors and nurses and other people who've been in this field for a long time move, then you know that it's a big deal. So Naomi had essentially experienced her husband of 5 years had assaulted her over 9 hours and the previous night. And he sexually assaulted her. He assaulted her with a weapon. He actually had pulled the trigger, fully planning to kill her, but it dry shot. And had actually done all this in front of their two children over the evening. And he actually fell asleep, passed out from exhaustion sometime around 3 or 4 in the morning. She, of course, was not able to, she was completely incapacitated, was not able to get up to call. Luckily, a family member showed up the next morning and called 911 when he saw what had happened. It was her grandfather. So she was immediately transported to the emergency room. And what we found there was that she had lost over 50% of her body, just body's blood volume, just due to bruising. So she, you know, as I said, was not to be too graphic, but it was the worst that I had ever seen. And gratefully, what we were able to do for her was to enter her into a system that was very complete. And it actually, and you know, sometimes we see systems not work, and sometimes we see them work. And this one, I think absolutely this time it did work. We hooked her up with counseling. She was in the hospital for four days. We brought her into our emergency shelter immediately after that. We addressed the needs for her children. We later worked with the district attorney's office to prepare for the trial, because, of course, her husband was arrested on 14 different counts, 11 of which were measure 11 counts. And so, you know, basically I think, you know, the success of this particular story is not only that she survived and that we were able to provide all those immediate services for her to get her safe from him and from her, you know, his family, but also that we were able to follow through with her through the district attorney's office and trial preparation. And the success story was that he was found guilty on all the counts and was put away on several Measure 11 offenses for, I believe, 43 years is what he's facing without parole. And we were able to relocate her to a new state. She's happy with her family now and sends us letters frequently. And so the poems that that you will get are ones that she has written, and it really speaks to the impact of what programs like ours do, as well as you know, what sorts of things that our programs do with the funding that you give. So that's just an anecdotal story, and I think you know, I just want to underscore that the funding that we receive helps us to do that, and it helps us to make an impact on those families individually. It's also helped, as an administrator of those funds, it's also helped our organization to leverage some other funding sources. For instance, we have been able to use some of that funding to increase our fundraising efforts, as well as recruiting volunteers. We log anywhere from 40 to 45,000 hours a year on volunteer hours. So that's a significant portion of our work is done by volunteers, which shows strong community support. We also are able to have been able to really decrease our reliance on governmental funding at Battered Persons Advocacy with this funding by doing board development, fundraising, those sorts of activities. So it really has made a big impact. You know, the last thing I'd probably say about the ODSVS funding as an administrator of it is that it's done an amazing thing for the flexibility has been very helpful, meaning, you know, of those 35 different sources of funding I mentioned, many of them are highly restricted as far as what we can and can't do with them. And so with the ODSVS monies, I'm able to put them towards, say, administrative costs or costs that help me to leverage some other sources of funding. So, you know, they've really made an impact, not just in the direct client service aspect, but also in the sustainability of our organization. So I thank you, and I welcome any questions you might have about the program or how that particular source of funding has been helpful for us.
Thank you. Please, Mr. Norris.
Thank you. I'm Dan Norris. I'm the district attorney in Malheur County, Oregon, Madam Chair, members of the committee.
And I neglected to say this at the beginning, but you'll have up to about 4 minutes.
And for a lawyer, I work for free for you, Senator Gorman. I'm also here to discuss the OBSVS funds. I have written a letter that Ms. Hebb from the Oregon Law Center will submit to you. I'm a member of the statewide VAWA board. I'm also a member of the board of directors of Project Dove, which is our local domestic violence shelter and services. As a prosecutor of many, many years, I unfortunately still remember the days when a police officer would respond to a call and tell a victim, "Wipe the blood off your nose, sweetheart. Cook dinner. It'll be better in the morning." I'm proud to say those days are over in the state of Oregon. And part of it is because we have safe victims. As an old-jaded prosecutor, I tell my deputies day in and day out, safe victims make good witnesses. When we have the ability to get victims to services, and we do the same thing in Malheur County that you just heard about, we can get the tech department to work on employment. We can work with housing. We can take away some of the power and control batterers have over the victims and give them the ability to support themselves and their children. And so we're successful because of the ODSVS funds. Why that's important? The other thing we see in the criminal justice system is one of the single biggest risk factors of kids going to prison on Measure 11 cases in the future is routine exposure to violence in their homes. If you look at any of the studies that the Department of Corrections has done, we know that's a truism. We know if we leave kids in those homes that they're going to come visit us 10 or 15 years down the line as adult criminals. It's costing us money in the future, and I know Senator Gordley and all of you know the cost. I don't know, but I'm guessing it's well over $30,000 a year. So this is a chance to invest in the children of the state of Oregon. Thank you.
Thanks to both of you for traveling the distance to help us understand how important these services are in the communities that you both serve. Thank you very much. Jim Bennett and Tanya Hunt. And they will be followed by Mary Botkin and Sybil Hebb.
Good afternoon. Good afternoon. Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for allowing us to be here today. I'm Tanya Hunt, Executive Director of the Children's Center of Clackamas County. And the Children's Center provides medical assessments for children who are suspected to be victims of abuse, meaning we provide a complete medical exam. We provide the opportunity for a videotaped interview with specially trained forensic interviewers. We also provide follow-up services to make sure that these children and the families are on the road to healing. That's the work that we do. I'm here representing the Children's Center, but also representing the Oregon Network of Child Abuse Assessment Centers around the state. There's 19 centers like the Children's Center who do this work, and as a network, we believe that the funding for the CAMI funding, the CFAA, and public safety funding is a very important funding stream for this work and allows us to continue to do it. I'm also here representing truly the victims, and that's the piece that is my passion. The children that we see oftentimes are victims of crime, victims of sexual crimes, victims of physical crimes, violent crimes against them and against other members of their family many times. Two of those victims I just want to tell you about briefly. Just a couple weeks ago, we had a very sweet little boy, very polite. He's probably maybe 8 or 9 years old, freckles across his face, dark black hair, and family from Lake Oswego. The family had a neighbor, a male friend of the family's that they trusted completely, and that male neighbor was now suspected of abusing that child, molesting him. That child and their family came to the Children's Center, was able to receive complete medical care, attention, make sure that he was healthy, a videotaped interview where he could tell his story completely once, and that videotape will be able to be used in other settings so that he doesn't have to retell his story over and over and over again. We also are continuing to provide services to that family to make sure that that child is getting into counseling and getting the help they need. We received a letter from the family, and I just want to read you briefly. Words cannot express the profound gratitude. Your tender, thoughtful care at a shocking and traumatic time could not have been better. I expected the worst. Instead, I was in the hands of angels. We will never forget your care. That's not about us. That's really about the professionals around us in the community that come together at the Children's Center, our doctors, our law enforcement professionals, our victims' advocates, our counselor, the DHS caseworkers. All of those people come together in our centers to provide these services in the best way possible for these kids. Another child, resident in Canby, Oregon, had a lived with a single dad, visited mom frequently, and in fact came home from mom's with a big black eye, 5 years old, beautiful little blonde with braids coming all out of her head, big black eye in her face, and she was referred to the Children's Center because of law enforcement wanting to know what was going on in that child's life. At the Children's Center, she came in still with that black eye fresh. We were able to document her abuse. The true concern for that child is actually she had experienced some vaginal bleeding recently, and the concern was now that mom's new boyfriend was molesting her and hurting her. These are the children we see every day. These stories are not extreme. These stories are not the rare instances. These are not the worst case scenarios we have to offer. This is our everyday work around the state for child victims of abuse. Currently, these services are funded in large part because of CAMI funds. CAMI, as you know, is a part of the Public Safety Fund, which is a part of the Criminal Fines and Assessment Account. Currently, the Criminal Fines and Assessment Account produces some dollars for general fund, some dollars for the Public Safety Fund, of which CAMI is a piece of. I know you know all of this. The governor has proposed that all criminal fines and assessment funds be transferred to general fund, and that all of these programs currently funded out of public safety be funded now out of general fund. The Network of Child Abuse Intervention Centers has a serious concern about that. We believe that the fact that criminals in the state, those who are convicted of committing crimes in this state, are paying for victim services makes a lot of sense to us and makes a lot of sense for our victims and their families. To keep that dedicated funding dedicated and designated for victim services and for child victims of abuse is something that we believe allows for the stability of this funding stream and also allows for the philosophical linkage that we should hold our offenders accountable and that the accountability continues into paying for services to our victims. Thank you for the opportunity. I'd be glad to take any questions from you.
Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
Hi, Madam Chairperson and members of the committee. My name is Gretchen Bennett, and I'm the director of Liberty House, the Child Abuse Center right here in Salem, and we're serving children in Marion and Polk counties. And I, like Tanya, am moved by the children that walk in our door every single day, and I'm grateful that she shared the story. My part today is to talk to you about some of the cuts that are proposed in the governor's recommended budget. We've taken cuts at each session. The 9901 allocation to centers, or to the CAMI funds, was a priority to centers was $7.9 million, and now the 05-07 governor's recommended budget is down to $6.5 million. So we've taken pieces each biennium, and it's just really starting to go down. And that's despite the criminal fines account line going up on the graph, if you take a look at the graph. And then there was an allocation method that was established back in the 1990s, and if that allocation method was still in effect, we'd actually have $9.7 million right now going towards child assessment services and child coordinated services. So we're real concerned about that reduction and where we are in relation, almost 50% less than where the original plan was in the 90s to be. And these regular incremental cuts each biennium carry an enormous impact. These dollars enable us to leverage other dollars. We work very hard at private fundraising and at corporate and business sponsorships. And we're also able to leverage medical insurance for the medical components of what we're doing. And so the CAMI dollars make an enormous investment in what we're able to leverage. I'm able to get over half of my budget coming from non-CAMI sources as a result of having CAMI there to anchor us and make that possible. And I know in other centers that's even higher. Cuts each session hurts Oregon's most vulnerable children, and I think these are the kids beyond anyone that we most certainly want to be sure receive an adequate and an appropriate response. So I know you're facing enormous challenges, but I would just make an appeal to you that these are our most vulnerable. I know demand in Marion and Polk counties for our services is increasing at about 15% each year. And right now we're only seeing 75%, we estimate, of the children that we should be seeing. And so to be walking into a biennium with additional cuts directly means I have to reduce the number of kids and families that we can say yes to. And that's a really challenging job. We also know our services make a difference. Research recently published in the August 2004 edition of the journal Child Maltreatment shows that we have increased and improved prosecution rates for children's cases that come to our center. We also, like Tanya, get the wonderful letters and cards from the children and families who are on their path to healing and indicate that we've made a difference in their lives. And so with that, I would just make an appeal to you as someone who gets to watch the kids walk through every day that they need you and we need the support. Thanks for your time, and I'd be happy to take any questions.
Thank you very much for your testimony, the quality of your testimony, and for your service to the community.
Thank you very much.
Well,
Oh, I also I have a written. If I need to have that. Yeah.
Thank you for providing written testimony. Sybil Hibb and Chris Bilhart. Followed by Jane Downing and Denise Washington. Thank you.
Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Sybil Hebb, and I am the legislative advocate for the Oregon Law Center. The Oregon Law Center is a statewide provider of civil legal assistance to low-income Oregonians, and we're here today on behalf or in support of the funds in the criminal justice, in the Department of Justice budget for the provision of services to domestic violence and sexual assault survivors. I'm here on behalf of the Law Center, but more importantly, I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Legislative Alliance to End Violence Against Women. And the alliance is a statewide grassroots network of advocates and representatives of victims programs that pull together to advance policy and legislative measures that will protect the interests of survivors of domestic violence and sexual assault. And their highest priority this session is funding, the stability of funding for the services throughout the state. So I'm here to help them advance that cause. I will keep my comments incredibly brief because the experts are to my left and behind me. I do just want to take a minute to tell you what is in the package that you have in front of you. And on the left-hand side, there is a sheet that describes some of the services that are provided with the Oregon Domestic and Sexual Violence Services Fund and some information about domestic and sexual violence in the state. Behind that sheet is a color-coded chart showing the numbers of victim services statistics throughout the state. And as you can see on the left-hand side, the state is divided into seven regions, and the chart shows you, moving to the right, the total number of domestic violence shelter beds that are available in each of these regions. And so, for example, taking district or region 6, which includes Crook, Deschutes, Gilliam, Grant, et cetera, counties, there are 56 shelter beds available in that entire geographic region. And moving forward to the right, the chart details the number of individuals and households provided shelter and the number of in-person contacts that a shelter might have with victims, for example, for support services or for peer counseling, as opposed to shelter. The next sort of yellow block of columns details the number of calls that each region gets from victims in the area. So, and then the final column is the total population. So that's some interesting information. The document behind that is a summary of a recent study done on intimate partner violence in the state of Oregon by the Department of Human Services. And behind that is a list of all of the victim services agencies in the state and the counties that they serve. The right-hand side I will not go through, but I will simply say that it contains letters of support from Dan Norris, who is the DA in Malheur County. You just heard from him. Also from Lane Roberts, the chief of police in the city of Redmond, Eric Bush, the chief of police in the city of Prineville, and Ramon Rodriguez, who is a detective in the Ontario Police Department, all of whom indicate the importance of these sorts of services for the work that they do as well. I'll conclude my remarks and pass the mic to Ms. Bilhart here. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Ms. Hill. Chair Gordley, committee members, I'm glad to have a few minutes with you today. My name is Chris Bilhart, and I am here as the director of Volunteers of America Home Free, which is a domestic and sexual violence intervention program in Portland. We work in the Tri-County area and provide a range of services, including emergency housing through motel vouchers,
which allows us to serve folks that normally would not be eligible for shelters. And we also provide children's services and a range of transitional services to help survivors who have left the emergency situation and are needing support in order to sustain the gains and the changes that they've made from coming out of crisis. We also have a lot of outstationed advocates who work in community-based settings, such as the Domestic Violence Reduction Unit of the Portland Police Bureau, at the courthouse helping with restraining order petitioners, and a number of other places so that we can increase the ways that folks can access services. I had some absolutely thrilling testimony prepared for you today, but with only a few minutes, I'll make just a few points. One is that with the proposed cut in this fund, it may not seem like a lot of money, but in the domestic violence services system, it's a huge amount of money. And I'll just give you an example from our own program. I'm saying this by way of asking that you try to look at preserving the funding for ODSVS at the $2.5 million level. That couple of $100,000 scattered around the state in various programs can help in very vital ways. In our program, our funds, our ODSVS funds, amount to only about $19,000 a year. But with that, we fund a full-time AmeriCorps member who works as a youth advocate and sees hundreds of kids each year who have been affected by domestic violence. It also helped us increase our administrative support so that direct service staff can spend more time with survivors and less doing paperwork. And it also provides us with flexible funds that we can use to help survivors pay things that could be huge, insurmountable barriers for them. A fee for an application rental to an apartment, a copy of a birth certificate that they need for one of their children, things that can sometimes drive them back because of those economic barriers to abusive relationships, we're able to assist them with. We do all that with $19,000 a year. Two other things I wanted to say. The money that pays for infrastructure costs, administrative costs, is a gift for us with all the limits that we have from other sources of funds. And rather than looking at that as something that helps us do administrative work and not the vital work of our programs, I think looking at it in terms of how it helps us sustain the programs and shore up everything that we do out in the community, it really helps us stay viable, it helps us stay afloat, and it helps us function smoothly and meet our contract requirements that keep the dollars coming in and allow us to continue delivering the services. Another unique thing about the ODSVS funds is the pot of money within that fund that pays for culturally specific services, that's earmarked for those services. In the Portland area, there are a number of programs that have developed to respond to the needs of specific populations. And our program works and relies upon our co-advocacy with those programs tremendously. We feel that it's a responsibility to provide sensitive and appropriate services to survivors, regardless of what community they come from, and without that expertise in our community that ODSVS funds have helped to support, it would be very difficult for us to have the expertise at hand to respond to those needs. I just will close with one recent letter that we got from a survivor, a participant in our services. We don't sometimes know what happens to the folks that we contact. Our contact with them may be a 15-minute time in the restraining order room as we help her fill out a petition. It may be much longer term, for up to 2 years. But sometimes we do get feedback, and we got recently a 3-page, very carefully handwritten letter from a participant in our program who went to great pains to express to us how much we had assisted her. The analogy that she used was seeing herself float in wild waves in the ocean in a boat with absolutely no way to move, no paddles. And her abuser was circling around her like a voracious shark. And we came along and helped her grab hold of the paddles and start rowing herself. Not rowing for her, but supplying her with the paddles that allowed her to direct her own craft. And ODSVS funds are vital in allowing us to keep up our stock of paddles. And thank you very much.
Very well put. And again, we thank both of you
for your service to the community. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Jane Downing, Denise Washington. Followed by Kevin Dowling. Okay.
Madam Chair, members of the committee,
good afternoon.
My name is Jane Downing, and I'm the Executive Director of Mid-Valley Women's Crisis Service, and we serve Marion County. We are actually the oldest continuous hotline in the state of Oregon for victims of domestic and sexual violence, and we've been around for 32 years providing services. We have a 24-hour crisis line that receives about 10,000 calls every year. We have 300 to 500 women and children who stay in our shelter. We have transitional housing, support groups, and community education. We have a website that's in English, Spanish, Russian, Vietnamese, large print, and audio, which receives 20,000 contacts a month around the world. And so we're providing a great deal of services right here in Marion County and throughout the state of Oregon and even reaching the world. And we're able to do that by putting together several different funding sources that make it possible for us to provide those services. One of those funding sources that's very important to us is the funding that you've been hearing about today through the ODSVS funds. And what I would like for you to know about that is that Mid-Valley Women's Crisis Service uses those funds to be able to do a great deal of work in the rural parts of Marion County. And for many of you, I know that your constituency appreciates being able to be reached wherever they are. And the same is true in our community. We're able to reach out to folks to say, we're here, we have services available. We will get up in the middle of the night and transport from anywhere in our county. And so we want folks to know that that service is available, because what we know is that rural individuals are going to have greater barriers. They're going to be more isolated. Transportation is going to be an issue for them. They're going to be coming up against all kinds of roadblocks to getting services. And so part of what we want them to know is that we're out there. We make sure we're going out into every community in our county. We take posters that are in English, Spanish, and Russian. We take out flyers in all different languages, and we let folks know about our services, and we meet one-on-one with victims out in the rural community. The ODSVS funds make it possible for us to reach out to those individuals that may not be able to find out about our services or to be able to get the social supports that they need in order to become free of domestic and sexual violence. And so I want you to please consider, I know you have so many people coming at you and saying funding is important, but what we know about domestic violence and sexual assault is that it's touched every person that you come in contact in some form, family member, friend, co-workers, whatever it is, we know they're going to be touched. And so by being able to provide this funding, we're going to be able to add greater stability to the community and ultimately have folks heal from domestic and sexual violence in every community in Oregon. I encourage you to consider having the funding at the $2.5 million level, which will help sustain our programs and help us to build the infrastructure that we need in order to do our work. And I thank you for your time, and I'm happy to take any questions that you may have.
Thank you for your testimony and for your passion.
Thank you.
Chair Gordley, members of the Public Safety Subcommittee. For the record, my name is Denise Washington, and I am the Executive Director of the Oregon Coalition Against Domestic and Sexual Violence. I am also the Chair of the Governor's Council on Domestic Violence and hold membership on the VAWA Advisory Board and the Department of Human Services Children, Adults, and Families Funds Advisory Committee. I want to speak to you today with a statewide perspective. But first I want to talk a little bit about the history of the funds. This fund is a direct result of a grassroots effort in this state. Advocates came together and conducted a needs assessment about the needs in the state of Oregon, and as a result of that determined, and this was in 2000, that in order to fully provide services four victims of domestic violence and sexual assault. This is children, this is women, this is the few men that are affected by domestic violence, this is having services in communities of color. The need then was identified as being $70 million. Well, we knew that we weren't going to get that. So we put together House Bill 2918 and came to the legislature, as we're doing now, with a request of $25 million. And we're absolutely astounded and grateful to receive $2.5 million. And that sounds like a little bit, but as you've heard today from the women who have spoken before me, that it has had a great impact on providing safety for women and children in your communities and in every county in this state. And I think that's very important. It was a giant step forward in the structure of state support for victims in our state. So I want us to hold on to that. You've also heard testimony today about the effects of the funds. You've heard that the services are reaching women and children in every county in the state. In your packet, as Sybil talked about, you have information about how many services were provided. You've heard also testimony about the effect that the funds have on the stability of programs. When I started in this movement 14 years ago, it wasn't uncommon to have executive directors of programs like Jane and Vanessa
and Chris,
thank you, making $25,000 a year. It wasn't uncommon to have advocates making $15,000 or $16,000 a year and having to be on food stamps and not being able to support their children. And the result of that, as you know, is that you have people who have a lot of dedication and passion. You've seen that in this room today, but have to move on because they can't support their families. They can't support themselves. And so another part of these funds is to provide that type of stability for programs, for advocates, so that those services are there when that phone rings in the middle of the night. And what we are saying today is that this funding is crucial for the state to be able to continue to provide these services through the programs located in the community. These are large programs. They're small programs. There's some programs that have three people, but they're doing incredible work. They are urban programs, rural programs, and programs that we call frontier, like Lake County is one that comes to mind. They work with communities of color, but what they are doing and what you are doing by supporting these funds and hopefully supporting an increase is you are supporting the safety of women and children who are victims of violence in our state. So as the director of the Oregon Coalition Against Domestic and Sexual Violence, I want to urge you to continue that support. And thank you very much for allowing me to talk with you today. Oh, I'm open to questions.
And thank you for the quality of leadership that you are providing around these services. Both of you have made it very clear that one of the things we need in our communities around the state is stability in these programs. And you've also made it clear that the service that you provide is safety.
Yes.
Thank you for underscoring that for us.
Thank you.
Kevin Dowling and Susan Fulframa. And I cannot read the last part of the name.
Dura.
My apologies. Please come forward. Good afternoon.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Kevin Dowling, and I'd like to thank you for your time and attention today. I work at CARES Northwest. We're a child abuse intervention center, like the ones that Tanya Hunt and Gretchen Bennett were talking about. We're one of 19 centers across Oregon. And I have to say, as nervous as I get public speaking, following such excellent testimony as they gave and the other people that have spoke before me, it's just truly humbling to work with the group of people that I work with. And I don't know that I have a lot to add. One thing that I did want to add, or that I thought I could emphasize, was those CAMI funds really support a coordinated team approach to child abuse in our community. And I think that that's really important to understand, because we at CARES could have the best child abuse medical clinic in the world, and it's really not going to do very much good if we're not coordinating those services with other providers in the community. So one thing I thought I could do is give you an example of how these different agencies and professionals work together by talking about a particular case that came to CARES. First, to give you a sense of the types of professionals on site at CARES, we have doctors, nurse practitioners, child abuse interviewers, on-call social workers, law enforcement officers. We have a child abuse hotline screener that's there at CARES, volunteers. We have a Spanish-speaking interpreter on site. And we represent a multitude of agencies under one roof that includes Dornbecker Children's Hospital, Emanuel Children's Hospital, Kaiser Permanente, Multnomah County Health Department, Multnomah County Mental Health, Portland Police Bureau, the Clackamas County Sheriff's Office, and the Department of Human Services. And at about 11 o'clock in the morning on a Thursday not too long ago, we received a call from a protective services caseworker. And that caseworker was concerned about two little girls, a four-year-old and one that was a little less than 1 year old. And the caseworker was concerned because the four-year-old had bruises on her head and her ear and her face, and she had bite marks on her arm. And she had said that her dad had bit her. There was also a concern that both girls had been living with a registered sex offender. And the children had been taken into protective custody at that time because they couldn't locate that sex offender who reportedly had lived in the home. And they weren't sure at that point about the mother's ability to protect. So that call came in at 11. At 11:23, we were able to staff that case with a physician at CARES to determine whether those children needed to be seen that day or we could schedule them the next day or the next week. We also talked to a police sergeant to find out if a detective had been assigned. We called and scheduled the appointment about an hour later and decided that the children did need to be seen that day. We worked with the police officer at CARES to get a copy of the police report and the screener, the hotline screener at CARES, to get a copy of the protective service history. Because oftentimes kids that we see, the concern that they're coming in with might seem relatively small. When you look at the history of concerns, it doesn't seem as insignificant anymore. Both children arrived at 2 o'clock that afternoon. They were accompanied by the protective service worker and the detective that had been assigned to the case. They were able to sit in an observation area and observe the evaluation. The child was seen by a doctor and a child interviewer. Both kids had a head-to-toe checkup. The four-year-old had a videotaped interview. Afterwards, we were able to make recommendations to the physician and the interviewer for follow-up care that included not just addressing the concerns of physical abuse, and the physician was able to diagnose the older child had been physically abused, but also ointment for the four-year-old's skin. Oftentimes kids come in and they have other needs. Over half of them have other medical concerns that haven't been addressed. Over half have been exposed to domestic violence. Over half have been exposed to drug and alcohol problems somewhere in their history. We were able to connect the protective service worker with a therapist that's stationed there at CARES to help with mental health follow-up for the family. And I understand that in this particular case, the offender admitted to hurting the 4-year-old, pled guilty, and is now in jail. 10 professionals coordinated services within 6 hours' time. That's what the CAMI funds really help us to do. They really support that team approach, and I really appreciate your time today and open to any questions you might have.
You've done an excellent job, along with others behind you, of really helping us understand the coordination, the links between the services. Thank you very much for being here. Good afternoon.
Hi, Madam Chair and rest of the committee. I hope I'm not out of line. I came to in support of another program through the Department of Justice, the Consumer Hotline. I do have to add a little bit into that. I work at a pediatrician's office in Woodburn, and I just have to, on behalf of all these people, say how thankful I am for what they do, because in my other job, I see everything that they're talking about, and without them, we'd all be lost. But I'm here with the Retired and Senior Volunteer Program on behalf of the Consumer Protection Fraud Department of the Department of Justice. My name is Susan Fofana-Dura, and I am the director of the Retired and Senior Volunteer Program of Marion County. We are a program that helps place senior volunteers 55 and older in agencies. We have volunteers at the consumer hotline who answer the telephones. We along with AARP, have helped to recruit the volunteers since 1995. I've been involved with it. And since 1995, we've had 68 senior volunteers contributing 24,000 hours towards the hotline work. And I guess I'm here willing to advocate for the continuing of that consumer hotline. It's really comforting for a person to call in and to be able to have a voice there and to have a voice, and a lot of times the voice is that senior citizen that's going to help direct them to other resources and help them through their dilemma, which in a lot of cases is fraud towards them. So, like I say, I'm here to advocate and hope that they continue to get their funding. And thank you very much, and I answer any questions anybody has.
Thank you very much. And again, thank you for your passion.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you both. Gary Weeks. And Mr. Weeks is the last person we have signed up for the day, and we have about 4 minutes remaining.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm sure I can do that in this time. For the record, I'm Gary Weeks, Director of the Department of Human Services. Appreciate the opportunity to be here. I'm here, Madam Chair, and members of the committee, to support the Attorney General's budget in a number of ways, but one specifically, and that has to do with a policy package that's in the Attorney General's budget that has a companion package in the DHS budget. It's a package that provides for legal support in court cases for our caseworkers. The department's DHS caseworkers have for many, many years appeared in court, and they've provided the court with opinions about cases and the kind of neglect that has gone on, and supported, I think, the court in its work. That role for the department, and specifically its caseworkers, has become more and more burdensome, to be direct with you, over the years. And part of it is the changes, I think, in federal legislation, in the sense that in 1997 the Congress passed the Adoption and Safe Families Act, and we in Oregon adopted that act 2 years later in 1999. The act, very briefly, is simply an effort to try to make decisions about children, to not have children languish in foster care for long periods of time, but to give the birth parents the opportunity, when a child is removed, the opportunity to try to get the family back together again, engage in whatever activities are necessary to restore this family. But failing to do that in a limited period of time, then the act directs us to move towards the termination of parental rights and some permanent solution for the child, generally meaning adoption of the child. So that act brought a lot more to us. It brought a lot more to the courts themselves, because they had to monitor all this. And so we're finding over time more and more effort being spent on the part of caseworkers in court. And they're not just sort of answering the court's questions. They're taking more deliberate actions. They're questioning witnesses. They're preparing court documents before the court. They're preparing documents for the court when the court has heard the case. And the short of this is that it takes people that are trained as child welfare workers and puts them in positions that they're not trained for, and winds up consuming a lot of time that ought to be spent between the caseworker and children and family, trying to restore families, or if not restore families, look for a permanent solution. And so we've talked with the Attorney General for quite a while about what kind of remedy there might be for this, and we came to an agreement on these two companion packages in our two budgets that would provide in the Attorney General's budget new Assistant Attorney General's positions that would be stationed regionally around the state, and that would represent us in court, would get our caseworkers out of the role of acting as attorneys. And I have to say to you, we've already had a couple of instances just in this last year where there have been allegations that our caseworkers are practicing law without a license, which I don't doubt. We're getting perilously close to that. But the Attorney General under this policy package would have additional positions to represent us. In turn, in the Department of Human Services budget, there are positions that are support positions, paralegal positions and other support positions to help the assistant attorney generals that are around the state. So it would enable us to get caseworkers out of court and be there only when they're needed to testify on a case, but not to do the work of the court, and let people that are trained, assistant attorney generals, actually represent the department and have paralegals prepare legal documents before the court appearance and subsequent to the court appearance. And so we feel this is a very important opportunity for us. We feel it's going to get a lot more mileage for us out of the caseworkers that we have. And I'm close to my 4 minutes, I believe, Madam Chair. I appreciate the chance to be here and to support the Attorney General on this package because I believe so strongly in its value to us as a department.
Are there questions, or Representative Hansen?
Thank you, Madam Chair. One thing that would be helpful, and I think I'm wearing double hat as part of the Human Services stuff, some type of a memo that would suggest a number, the amount of time that would free up for the caseworkers, if that would, whether it translates into a certain number of FTE or a certain number of hours, or what would the associated benefit in terms of more caseworkers than I mean.
I'm sure Representative Hansen will try to prepare something for you. I mean, we are supporting this package in part by abolishing some positions. I mean, we believe that this will save so much money that we're actually abolishing some positions in order to support the creation of new positions, because across our system we think it's going to make such a difference. But we will try to have for the chair and all the members here something that you've asked for and get it to you as quickly as we can.
Thank you very much, Mr. Weeks. We appreciate you being here this afternoon. Members, we're going to carry over House Bill 5044 for continued hearing tomorrow. Again, thanks to all of you who came to testify. We appreciate that very much. Members, the Board of Parole and Post-Prison Supervision is also scheduled for tomorrow, Phases 1 and 2. And then just a reminder that next week we'll be moving into the Oregon Youth Authority and Department of Corrections agencies.
Madam Chair,
Mr. Wilson.
On Friday morning around 10 o'clock we'll be leaving for the tour of the state penitentiary. She'll be back somewhat soon after noon. Why don't we meet as we did with the OIA? I'll send an email yet this afternoon or tomorrow on the exact time. It somewhat depends on your meeting with the co-chair, Senator.
We'll be, Madam Chair, staff can come on that if they've already got it.
Yes, but there's another thing that you'll see in your email. I do need names of those folks sometime tomorrow, as well as each of you will have to carry bring a picture ID to get in.
I was going to say something else.
Thank you, Mr. Attorney General, and all of your staff for your participation today. Representative Hansen?
Very quickly, make a comment in support of the consumer protection. We had a situation in my family with one of the children receiving an incredibly high cell phone bill that was improperly billed, and that drug on for months and months and months. And there was no response from the company until we sent them a letter and said at the bottom of the letter that we were providing the Attorney General with a copy, and we received a call from someone in the office the next business day after they received the letter. So besides what shows up in terms of the active cases, just the reputation of the Attorney General's office is also a significant help, I'm sure, to a lot of consumers.
Very good. Thank you, Representative Hansen. We're adjourned.